So, extrapolating James Mangold's future, I have to believe that Indiana Jones 5 will be the last Indiana Jones movie. Hopefully.
Four, the four.
For
I don't
all of our
understand.
sakes.
Five, is that okay?
Right, of course, yeah.
Just a slip of the tongue. I got you. Yeah.
I dreamed it up when I was a kid, so in my brain it just skips to five. With that and like this movie, I was just thinking about how many characters like in pop culture are stuck in that, like they could maybe come back, or like they'll pop in as a cameo in this franchise that'll go on forever. Like I feel like the Terminator is one where it's like, oh, what if we got Arnold again? Does that interest you guys? And I just want to know, what is a character that you guys would like to see get the Logan treatment from James Mangold in pop culture? And just like, it's
You
settled,
mean just kill
it's
him off?
done. Well, end their story so that there's no further, there's absolutely no chance that they come back.
That's a good question.
And I have two, so I'll start
Oh,
with
good.
one and we'll see if I circle back around. But
Yeah.
I love Tom Cruise. I think the newest string of Mission Impossible movies are all pretty great, and I'm excited for 7 and 8. I don't know that Mission Impossible needs to make it to 10 movies. And like Tom Cruise is only getting older. Even in Ghost Protocol, he looked like a sack of potatoes whenever he had his shirt off. And so like
Aww.
and again, I love Tom Cruise, but like I could see a good like let's go ahead and put the wraps on this franchise, let Ethan Hunt go out with some dignity movie as like Mission Impossible 9.
Okay. I could see that. Although I'll present the counter argument. Make 30 of those. That'd be okay.
Oh.
I'd be
Well.
I mean, if they start diminishing, sure. Let's figure out a way to wrap this up beautifully. But I'm okay. I mean, that last one was
Right.
unbelievable.
Once we get to like X-Men Origins
Sure,
Wolverine
yeah, there you
quality
go.
of Mission
Yeah.
Impossible movies,
Yeah.
then we can talk
Yeah,
about
there you go.
it.
There you go. Man, this is a good question. I what about James Bond? What if we did the definitive end of the story for James Bond? And then you could keep doing the 007 thing if you want to, or move him to 008 and bring in Idris Elba, or whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do is fine with me. But we're the character, the James Bond character, rather than the 007 moniker. Maybe we're going to give him the send-off that he deserves. I don't know. I could deal with that.
Yeah, and that one's a weird one too. I'm not
Yeah.
real attached to James Bond. I've only seen
Everyone's
like
dad
one
is
or two
mad that
movies.
I just said we should kill off James Bond, just for the record. I understand. I'm
Right.
sorry. To my dad and any other dads out there.
What I think irritates me most about the James Bond thing is just like that it's the Broccolis, right? Like that's the people that own the rights. That they're just like, well, a woman
Right,
could never be
right.
James Bond. They're like, listen, we have to be very strict about what James Bond is. And so, like, on that level, I could definitely get with, like, let's let that character and all of his problematic sides, like, go and bring
Sure.
it into a new era and just keep moving for sure. Paige, do you have a character?
No, the only thing that's like popping into my mind is stopping all the Shrek sequels, and that's just not a good answer. So I don't know. I was just like, can we make those
A
stop?
real gritty R-rated donkey movie where he finally gets the ending he deserves. I don't.
It's like what we've been waiting for all this time.
Do you think dragon sex would work as well as fish sex for the Oscars? Do you think that they could swing that
I mean, not you never know until you try it, I would say. So.
My other one, and it's hard because like in some ways she had the perfect ending, but my other one would be Ripley from Aliens. And I really dislike David Fincher's Alien Cubed. I think that movie's kind of garbage, but like the ending is so good for that character. And then the franchise just decided to like resurrect her as this weird clone in, I mean, I kind of like that movie Resurrection, but it does a huge disservice to that
great
character.
Basketball player though.
So like,
so got that.
Oh, Brian.
So painful.
What's funny is when I told you I was watching that movie, yeah, you know, I put it in the Discord and you were like, get ready for the basketball scene. And so I was like, ready. I thought, but there's no way to be ready for that.
That was like 1997. And that's what we thought basketball was in 1997. I was appalled when I was up. Not whatever, 12 or whatever I was. It's just like, what are we doing here? Not as bad as Catwoman, though. I don't know if y'all have ever seen Catwoman, but the basketball scene in that is like an abomination. It's one of the most offensive things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I heard it's horrible. Thankfully, like the narrative on Catwoman for my entire existence with it, from like the moment it entered my consciousness, was Catwoman's terrible, and my curiosity has never been piqued enough to check that out. There's just too many other good things in the world for me to watch to circle back to Catwoman. But yeah, so there's like maybe a world where they have like a Ripley clone come back at some point. I think, you know, people have tossed that rumor around for a while, and I just want that character to, you know, she's great. She's one of the greatest characters in sci-fi. Like, just let's let her go, you know? And I still like the alien world. Like, I'm all down for if Ridley Scott wants to make his third of the trilogy. I don't care at all about the alien TV show set on Earth. That sounds real bad to me. But, like, I would take more alien movies. Let's just let the idea of Ripley go.
I've only seen, like, 1.5 of them. But the Fast and the Furious movies, is that the same character carried over through all of them?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Dom for the is in all but the second one. I mean, sort of in the third one. So all the canon ones, yeah. Yeah, the ones that matter, I think. Yeah, yeah. No, I thought about that too, Paige. I was like, that'd be...
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be a weird... And that also is another one that I'm like, 30 is fine. Like, we can keep going forever, but I keep my podcast going for a long time anyway. But
right,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, those are sort of diminishing. I would never say that on my airwaves, but I can say it on yours. I mean, they're, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You come to my show, I'll tell you, they're all A++.
Yeah, we don't have listeners, so you're fine.
Yeah, please nobody report that to Vin. I don't want him to think I turned my back on family. But no, the you could definitely talk me into one last ride, as it were, so to speak, and James Mangold's coming in to take us home. I could be with that. I could yeah, do with that.
I think the funniest part of Fast 9 for me was like, because I really loved In the Heights, which was like the movie the weekend before, and it was, or like 2 weekends before, I think. Obviously, that movie, like, notorious box office disaster now. God knows what happened with it. But, like, it got pushed out of theaters for Fast 9, and I feel like just everyone around me in the air was like, I can't wait for Fast 9. Like, sure, all I want to do is see Fast 9 on the biggest screen. Mm-hmm. It's going to be so great. And then, like, I just sat there and watched the letterbox, like, 3 stars, 3 stars, 3 stars roll in. Yeah. And people were like, yeah, it was what I expected, 3 stars.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, I guess that's what we get excited for these days.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a lesser version of some of the better ones from that series, but I am always going to be, I mean, I'm not kidding. If they do 30 of them, the 30th one,
yeah,
I'm there. I'm going to be hyped like the full year before it comes out. I'll like take a day off of work when the trailer comes out. I mean, no problem. I'm locked and loaded, but I'm here for the duration.
Well, on that note, let's say goodbye to, maybe one of the most iconic characters of the last couple of decades, guys. And let's talk about Logan.
This is Discovering Directors.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discovering Directors, a podcast where we talk about a director's entire filmography, one week at a time, one movie at a time, to tell the story of that director's entire career, chart their highs and lows, and get to their themes and different movie-making abilities.
I love that it's always something different, but you lose confidence halfway through every time.
I feel like it's the third, like I try and go for a third one.
Yeah.
Because rule of three, and I can't handle, I can't sustain the third one ever.
Yeah. Yeah. You just gotta stop while you're ahead.
Yeah. Well, my name is Ethan Tyler Paula Chaffee Cooper.
My name is Paige and Mizath Marie Cooper.
And today we are joined by past guest on this show, friend of the show, Brian Gill from the Mad About Movies podcast. Brian, say hello to the people.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Sorry about all the terrible curse words I said last time. I didn't think you guys would have me, but I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Just don't listen to me ranting on the Night and Day episode then, because I just edited that a few days ago, and it's just me cursing about how mad I am about the use of the word night instead of night, so... You know, it was a bad experience.
I respect it. I respect it.
Yep.
I mean, you know, Brian, we had you on to talk about WALL-E. Things got a little racy when you started talking about Eve, but, you know, we made it through.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys editing that down to an acceptable level. It was, I was offended by my own statements, honestly.
Oh, man. Well, today we are getting close to the end of our fifth season. This has been our season on James Mangold. And today we are talking about, at the time of recording, his penultimate movie, Logan, his second time visiting the X-Men franchise. And before we jump into talking about this movie, Brian, I feel like we got to do just a little bit of housekeeping on two different bits. So first off, just your opinion on James Mangold and his movies, and what drew you to pick, I guess, this episode.
Yeah, this is...
Without getting too deep to your Logan thoughts.
Yeah, Mangold's interesting because... And I was thinking about this afternoon when I was getting ready to come on, because, like... If I was in y'all's shoes, if I was watching this, all of his movies back to back to back, maybe it would be a little different, but I haven't. Sorry, I didn't prepare that well. But he's a really good director who, to me, doesn't have a definitive style. Like, you could watch 310 to Yuma, or you could watch Ford v Ferrari, or you could watch this movie, and I don't know that you would have real connection, like, say, oh, I bet this is by the same guy. Like, they don't really necessarily feel all the same. Whereas I think if you watch three Steven Spielberg movies spread out across three decades, you'd be like, well, those are probably all the same guy. Like, they just have that Spielbergian feel to it. Scorsese, same thing, you know. Most, like, for sure, the great directors, and maybe Mangold's not quite in that great director category yet, but whatever it is, most, like, really well-known name directors, they kind of have their own style that's very, if not unique, then it's easy to spot and be like, okay, these are the hallmarks of what his or her movies are. And I don't necessarily know, there's not a through line to me between all of his movies at this point, or even like most of his movies. So it's just, he's kind of interesting on that front, but he's a very talented director. It's just, it's been interesting to watch. If you look at his filmography and see, kind of, it's not quite roller coastery, but to have like Walk the Line, which, you know, is like fine, it's a good movie, yeah, that got a lot of, but it got a ton of like nominations and you know, award buzz and all that kind of stuff, so like that's valuable, like, that's a big deal. And it's sort of at a strange place in his filmography as compared to like what usually you would see. I mean, everybody has a down movie here and there, but usually you would kind of see it maybe build to something and then plateau at that point, or just continue to rise from this really high peak. And instead it's like, hey, I did Walk the Line, and then 3:10 to Yuma was a big deal, and then like Night and Day, what are we doing? And the Wolverine movie that didn't quite measure up to everybody's expectations and everything like that. And those are, I mean, they're... What's the spread? It's like 12 years between Walk the Line and Logan. That's a really long time to go from that movie to this movie. And then the stuff that he did before is interesting too. Like Girl Interrupted too. I forgot he even did that. I'm looking at the filmography right now. It's like, that is another one that had a ton of awards buzz. And then he followed that up with Kate and Leopold, you know, and
He sure did.
We've been having fun this season.
Yeah. It's just very. He's got a very strange filmography, and I respect that. I think it's really cool that you can. He's not just locked into one thing, but it is harder to get kind of a grasp of like what is a James Mangold film, you know, as compared to some other director, even like Frank Oz. I mean, Frank Oz, it was from last season. He's got a couple outliers too.
No, he's good, but
There is like, I think there's, you can see sort of a through line between, I don't know, the majority of his movies. It's not necessarily the same thing with him. But that's cool. You know, I think that maybe what, I don't know if that shows that he early on, especially is like just taking what comes to him or if it's a varied interest thing or, you know, don't put me in a box or I don't know what the what the answer is on that, but it's he's got a strange filmography comparatively to some of the other directors of his time.
I think like with Mangold, what interests me a lot about his directing style is I think you're right, like it's hard to pin it down. I mean, in some ways we shot ourselves in the foot by our first season being Wes Anderson, and he's so easy to nail down that it's like, you know, there's only so far up we could go from there. But like, to me, James Mangold as a director is so interesting because he kind of has those chameleon sensibilities where he can kind of blend into different styles. I mean, I say it all the time, but like, I do think that the vast majority of his movies borrow heavily from Westerns, like even when they're not Western genres. I mean, they're not like specifically Western, but like James Mangold seems like the kind of guy to me who's not necessarily trying to make next year's best picture winner. And I think like he tells this story all the time in a bunch of different interviews where he said like he went on a family trip to Yellowstone. And before he went in the park, like, they went to go see Star Wars in theaters, you know, just the super pivotal moment for him. And he said, like, he doesn't remember anything at all from Yellowstone, but he remembers, like, calling his family back home and being like, when I get back home, like, we have to go see Star Wars again. And, like, I think it's just that once he kind of got through the first couple of, like, important movies that, like, we've talked about, like, from Heavy to Girl Interrupted, on some level, I feel like he's just trying to make movies that are entertaining, but then also like whatever movie he's making, he's going to put himself completely into telling that story or that genre, if that makes sense. Like something like Walk the Line, Brian, like you said, is a fine movie, but it's like, so, you know, he spent years interviewing Johnny Cash and June Carter for that movie, and then like on top of that, it's just like the most music biopic a movie has ever been. Sure. Like, it's 110% music biopic, and I feel like that's kind of the magic of like Ford v Ferrari. I mean, we haven't got there yet, but like everyone and their mom told me when that movie was getting a lot of attention in 2019, like, you don't have to care about cars, like James Mangold will sell it to you. Mm-hmm. You know,
for sure.
And that's all I've heard is like he just puts you so far into that world that like even if you went in with zero interest, like you're gonna come out still having a good time. So
yeah, I think that's you're totally right. I think there's a real, if there's a through line on all his stuff, there's a real commitment, I guess, maybe is the best word to put it. Like, he seems very serious about making the best version of whatever movie he's trying to make, even if it is a movie like Identity that's not great, you know, or something like that. Yeah. Like he's very, I wonder if he would maybe not be fun to hang out with because he's very serious about stuff. And I have no idea. I've never even seen an interview with him beyond just like, you know, reading one here or there. Like, I'd be interested to hear him on a podcast maybe. But he seems like the type of person who might be like super into the minute details that you're like, cool, man, but like, I mean, you know, this this movie is just like a biopic. We could just stop for the day. That'd be cool, you know. But I don't know. It would. But it seems like he's very passionate about making sure that if whatever he stamps his name to, it's going to be as good as he can make it, or as well thought out as he can think it out, I guess.
Yeah, I think so too. And the ones that, you know, don't come out that way, I think he's very quick to distance himself from.
Sure.
Like Kate and Leopold in Night and Day.
Sure. Yeah.
But then, so then on top of that, Brian, last week we had a long kind of X-Men movie discussion, especially because we will never cover a single director of any of the other X-Men movies for obvious reasons. But do you have just like general X-Men thoughts or like Wolverine thoughts or X-Men movie thoughts? I guess like what is your pre-Logan?
Sure.
How are you feeling about the franchise at this point?
I love X-Men so much. It's the only I never was a comic book reader growing up. Like I knew, we always say on our show, you know, because every once in a while we'll get griped at about like, you guys are just in Marvel's pocket. And I'm like, I would love to be in Marvel's pocket. That would be fantastic. But like I had no attachment or even familiarity with 90% of the Marvel universe prior to those movies coming out. I knew who Batman was, obviously, and Spider-Man, and like that's kind of it. Like I was really the only I was a star, my household was a Star Wars household, so that's like what I put most of my my time and energy and whatnot into. I didn't read comic books. I didn't have a whole lot of familiarity with it. When the X-Men animated series came out, when I think I was in fifth grade when that show came up on Fox, and it was like kind of life-changing. Like it just was the coolest show, and I was the perfect age for it too, because it was like a, I don't know if y'all have ever watched that. I know it's on like Disney Plus and stuff now, but it's a pretty mature show.
Oh yes, okay. Brian, I have.
All right, good.
I like grew up with that.
Okay.
As well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that and like Batman the animated series is the same way too. But the themes of X-Men are just so universal and easy to identify with. And so, you know, the fact that all these things that are like real life stories, and that's like the whole point for Stan Lee is creating these characters that stand for the people in our society that were being looked down upon or downright outcasts when that comic book series started. And you know, we've not gotten super much better in a lot of ways. So, but yeah, like it's very relevant, those characters and the way that they all interact together. And the X-Men just seem so cool too. They all look cool. They have like that show, especially like has like sort of a teen angst kind of written into it. And I wasn't quite a teenager when it came out, but you know, it was like sort of bubbling underneath the surface, you know, of like this is coming soon. And I loved that show, and I got really into the X-Men from there. And I still wasn't like a huge hardcore comic book reader, but every comic book that I've ever read is X-Men related, like in my entire life. Even still, like maybe once or twice a year, I've got a buddy who's still really into comic books, and I'll be like, "Hey, man, what's going on? What's an X-Men comic that I can get into, that I can read, like that's in a volume, you know, that I can pick up
right,
or something?"
Absolutely.
And I'll still do those every once in a while. But yes, I love all those characters. The show is great. I collected the action figures when they first came out. And then when the first X-Men movie came out in 2000, that was like, this is going to be just the cool. I could not wait for that movie to come out. And then it's pretty good. And X2 is great. Like, that's a really good movie. And since then, it just feels like we've been on a roller coaster with X-Men movies of like one garbage, one good, one garbage, one. I mean, and you never can get a the timelines don't always make sense, or maybe ever make sense. No. Yeah. No. So
we tried to decipher it a little bit last week, and it's just not worth it at this point.
Yeah. And so they're super messy, and some of it to me is easily forgivable. Like the timeline stuff, I'm kind of like, yeah, it's fine, whatever. They've never made sense timeline-wise, so I'm okay with it. I can just accept that in my brain. But some of the other stuff is just like, what? This is utter garbage. And so Wolverine is like probably not my favorite of the X-Men because I love Gambit for some reason. And
absolutely, Brian.
Gambit's super cool. Yeah. Yeah. But Wolverine is definitely the face of X-Men, I think. Maybe Professor X. Maybe Professor X is the face of X-Men. But regardless, he if you're talking to somebody who's never really paid much attention to the X-Men, you can maybe float Gambit out there, but they're likely not to know who you're talking about. But if you bring up Wolverine, kind of everybody knows who Wolverine is. And so I think there's some cultural zeitgeisty value in that character. And so I think it's easy to see why he, of all the X-Men, is the one that has been put forward so much. And there's been so many attempts to make a standalone movie or standalone series maybe out of Wolverine and Logan and everything. He's a really interesting character. Jackman does a fantastic job of portraying him, obviously, even in the bad ones. Right. He's still pretty great.
I think it's like after the first one, like he just so clearly popped over the rest of the cast that it was like, even though they positioned like Rogue to be the main character, it was very clear that they were going to have to pivot for X2 to just like put, you know, Jackman front and center.
For sure. I think like that first movie, I'm not here to praise Bryan Singer, obviously, but like the first movie, I think it's hard to watch that one 20 years later and not without like sort of the context of like, there were not superhero movies. We had Batman movies and that's it. Right. Like they're just, you know, this was like the first one. And so when it looks like it's being filmed on in the back of an alley somewhere and stuff, it's like, yeah, well, I mean, we didn't really know what to do yet. And so it figured him out really quick. 'Cause X2, I think, is still one of the best superhero movies of all time. And it's, I don't know. All of them are, I think they're great. I love Days of Future Past. That's one that people are real hit or miss on, but that's one.
I love Days of Future Past, so I'm right there with you.
I mean, I'll watch that. This is one of the few series or franchises that I will, because you know how much of a completionist I am. This is one of the few that I'll be like, yeah, I can sit down and watch one of these. That's fine. I don't need to watch all of them. It's okay to just pop on Days of Future Past or whatever. But anyway, to get to the character, Origins just seems like such a good idea and just, or at least like such an understandable idea. And it just, man, it doesn't hit it. I think I said to you in the Discord when you said you were watching, I was like, that is a bad movie that I do not hate for some reason. Like, I just I can't not kind of be like, yeah, you know, it's okay, I guess. I don't know.
Last podcast episode, I had to eat a little bit of crow because, like, for five seasons, whenever X-Men Origins Wolverine came up, which happened a lot for some reason, I don't really know why, I would be like, oh, that's like a movie that I defend. Like, I think that's pretty good still. And then I watched it with Paige last week to prepare for the Wolverine. And I was like, oh, no, this is really bad. Yeah.
It's like, it's impossible to defend. It's impossible to defend. But it just seems like such a good idea on paper, especially in 2009 or whatever. I mean, it just like, that should make sense. It should work. And even when I haven't watched it in a while, so maybe if I watch it tomorrow, I'll be like, no, here's the problems with it. But even when watching it, I'm like, it's kind of hard to pinpoint exactly what's wrong with this. Like, it has something there, and it just, I don't know. It doesn't come out in the wash, I guess, when it all comes down. But yeah.
I still say that Liev Schreiber's Sabretooth is like a saving grace.
Pretty good,
movie,
yeah.
I think it's really good.
It's just, it's a strange one. It's a strange movie to try to like critically, look at critically, because you can accept like this is not good, but then you can, I don't know, it's just it's hard to tell. I remember being wholly underwhelmed by The Wolverine when it came out and just being like, that was fine, I guess, but didn't seem like it had the, I almost would say that Jackman feels the least Wolverine-y in that, even compared to like Origins. Like his performance in that movie just kind of doesn't really hit the marks for me as compared to some of the others. It's just kind of a forgettable movie to me. But then I don't know, but then with this one I remember being like, okay, but this is the last try. Like, we can't keep just rebooting this exact same thing and trying to get away with it. And so thankfully, spoiler alert, it's a great movie, and so it gets the character right, and I think frames him correctly, and you get like that movie that we have always wanted with Wolverine that so many of the other ones just weren't quite able to achieve.
Yeah.
To use your word, do you think this is the most Wolverine-y one?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean,
X2 is very Wolverine.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I mean, it's obviously a different version of Wolverine, and obviously by purpose. But it just really, this movie really lets you see all that is that character. And I'm not somebody who's like, I think we push for things to be R-rated too frequently, and studios make that mistake quite frequently, I think, of like, well, you know, Logan and Deadpool did well, so obviously we have to make a grittier version of whatever we're making and get up to that R rating. But like, this is a character and a story both that really not only like benefit from it, but like maybe actually need that lack of restraint that you get when you're able to go with an R-rated movie. Because it's also like, this is I'm really jumping into it now, but it's like, it's not gratuitous. Like, it's really, I mean, it's super hyper violent, and obviously he's just like cutting people's throats out.
But it could be so much worse.
Yeah, if you put this in the hands of like Matthew Vaughn, it's like, oh my gosh, like I can't even look at the screen, you know, or James Gunn too, you know. I mean, it would get comical in a way, I think, or just so like, oof, I'm going to pass out, there's too much blood. But I think that character, and again, this, it's not just the character, it's this particular story. Because like, you can do PG-13 Days of Future Past, and I think Wolverine fits into that perfectly, no problem. There was never a time in Days of Future Past where I was like, be really cool if this was R-rated, you know. But with this particular story, it would be a disservice for this movie to be PG-13. We would have to play down the tone, which is a huge part of what makes this such a Wolverine-centric film, you know, especially at this point in his life and whatnot.
And I think, like, with the Wolverine too, like, his powers are just so innately violent. Mm-hmm. Like, the man does one thing. I mean, he said, you know, it's like the famous Wolverine catchphrase, like, he's the best at what he does, and what he does isn't very nice. Yeah. Like, he has fucking knives that come out of his hands, and like, it is a little odd after seeing Logan, like, going back and watching some of the older X-Men movies where it's like, oh, Wolverine's gonna cut this guy, and it's like, oh, he just like kind of swiped at him, and then the guy fell down. Whereas like in this movie, you know, obviously he like punches through like 17 different guys' heads with his claws, and it's like, but it's like you said, Brian, like, to be on the level of this character at this point in the story, like, it's time to actually let his claws have consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. There needs to be, I think, for this story to work, there has to be stakes. And again, I'm not somebody who advocates for hyperviolence in movies, you know, at any time. But like, you need to, I think, for that character to really be the character that he is in this movie, you need to kind of like almost feel the strikes and stuff as he's as he's, you know, murdering people and stuff. I mean, you need to, that needs to be almost like just south of visceral, I think, before it to tap into what that character is actually going through in this storyline.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the production of this movie and kind of how things came into place for James Mangold here. So immediately after The Wolverine released, Fox came to James Mangold and was like, hey, we want you to complete the trilogy. Like, it's got to be you. Like, The Wolverine actually, you know, kind of subverted people's expectations. Like, it got more critical acclaim than, you know, X-Men Origins Wolverine or Apocalypse got. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, we need you to go ahead and take this franchise home. And Mangold was like, yeah, I'll do it, but I'm going to like put it on the back burner. I've got kind of this idea brewing that's basically like a bloody Little Miss Sunshine is how he describes it.
I hate that.
I do just love the idea of picking like an indie movie and being like, I want to do a bloody version of that. Like, I can't wait for the bloody take on Minari in like 5 years.
Right.
But anyways, so in the meantime, he was working on another film, which was an adaptation of a book called The Deep Blue Goodbye by a guy named John McDonald. And apparently this is like a rather famous fictional character, like book series, like the Travis McGee novels. And they're all like, it's kind of a Jack Reacher-esque thing, but it's like a guy who's retired. He's by himself, and then he gets kind of like pulled into espionage and action and whatever. And it's supposed to star Christian Bale as Travis McGee. And then Rosamund Pike and Peter Dinklage were like also attached. And so this movie was like set to go. And they were, it had been in development since the 1990s. Like originally Leonardo DiCaprio was attached to star at some point. And then it was like supposed to be directed by Oliver Stone or Paul Greengrass. And it like finally landed on James Mangold and Christian Bale. And Mangold says he like flew to Puerto Rico, like started to build sets, like was getting everything ready. And then Christian Bale tore his ACL on the set of The Big Short. And his doctor was like, you absolutely cannot go film another movie right now. So like, not happening. And so like the studio real quick turned around and tried to call just like any actor they could get a hold of any clout.
Did they ask Tom Cruise? Because he's always second choice.
Well, they have to want Adam Sandler in the first place to get Cruise as the second choice. That's how it works.
My bad.
But they like called Brad Pitt apparently, and he was like, no, I can't do it. So they like went through this list of actors. None of them could do it. And so the studio just like completely shut down production on the movie, and it's never been picked back up like to this day.
That's
They've
crazy.
Just never gone back to that. But so James Mangold said he like literally flew down, set up all the sets, and then tore them all down and then flew home. And like that was something that he had worked on for like 2 years at that point. But as soon as he came back, he said like he just immediately started working on the sequel to The Wolverine. And he added a couple of co-writers, a guy named Scott Frank, who wrote The Wolverine with him and also wrote like Minority Report for Spielberg. And then Michael Green, who had just like one of the craziest 2017s of all time, because he wrote this movie, Alien Covenant, Blade Runner 2049, Murder on the Orient Express, and the American Gods television series, like produced and written by him.
Man.
So, you know, that's like, yeah, that's a good little cleanup year for Mr. Michael Green. And so like the early rumors were that this was going to be an adaptation of the Old Man Logan story. Now, Brian, have you read Old Man Logan?
Yeah, I have. I don't believe I had prior to this movie being, I know I read it before I saw this movie. So it was probably somewhere in that, like the 6 months before the movie came out, because I thought that that's what this movie was going to be. Like I was
right.
The first 10 minutes, 20 minutes of this movie, first time around, I was like, this is weird. That's not what happened in the comic book at all. Or the graphic novel, excuse me, but I'm into it. You know, I did not get the memo that it was not based on Old Man Logan prior to starting the movie for the first
time. And I think that's what all the rumors were, because like Old Man Logan is probably my favorite run of comics ever. Like I love it so much, but it's so dark. And for anyone who doesn't know, like, the premise of Old Man Logan is basically all the supervillains decide to team up and they manage to kill all the other superheroes except for, like, Wolverine and Hawkeye, basically. And so it's just, like, 50 years down the road from that event, Wolverine is, like, starting to age. He's got a family. And for reasons, he has to, like, set out across this United States of America that's now, like, completely covered by villains to, like, help his family. And I really, really love it. But James Mangold said, like, originally that idea came to him and he just immediately had to toss it out because it was, like, in that story, it uses a ton of Marvel supervillains and not just, like, X-Men ones. And so it was either, like, recast all these parts with, like, X-Men-adjacent supervillains, which wouldn't hit as hard, or, like, Marvel was never going to give the rights to Fox to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So, like, that was right out. And then also James Mangold said, like, it's just so dark. Like, it's too dark for the movie I'm trying to do, which is, like, you know, put not a nice end to the story, but, like, wrap things up in a way that people can emotionally process. And if this thing's too dark, like, that's just not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, like, a couple other things that kind of got thrown out were, like, the post-credits scene of X-Men Apocalypse was supposed to hint at the idea of, like, Mr. Sinister being in this movie as the supervillain. And James Mangold, like, completely said, absolutely not. I'm not putting, like, a guy in white face paint and, like, weird dyed hair and, like, a big purple spandex suit as, like, the villain in my movie. Like, it's just not happening. So, like,
I think that would fit in pretty nicely, honestly.
Just put some scarves on him and it's Johnny Depp, you know?
Man. Hey, there you go. Perfectly. Sinister is, like, maybe one of my favorite X-Men villains of all time, but, like, definitely would not at all work in this movie. So I'm glad that Mangold had the idea to hold back on that one. And then, like, also at some point, Liev Schreiber was also supposed to appear to help, like, them when they get to Oklahoma City. And again, it was cut out because they didn't want to just have, like, a bunch of little cameos or Easter eggs. And so James Mangold kind of fell in love with the idea of being able to put the Wolverine, like, to sleep, you know, like, be like, this is the end of this character. And so when he realized that he could use Patrick Stewart, he was like, okay, I'm going to give, like, these two guys one last ride as their characters, settle it out. And he went to the studio and he was like, I need full control over this movie. It's going to be R-rated and I'm going to cut it however I want, end it however I want. And the studio, like, gave him a little bit of pushback. And then he was like, hey, remember in The Wolverine when I told you, like, audiences are going to hate the end of this movie with the big silver samurai and you guys made me put it in? Well, like, that's the number one thing that critics hit on, was, like, the end of that movie sucks. And he was like, you have to just trust me. And then, like, on top of that, they had already approved the R rating, but I'm also sure that Deadpool's financial success helped him a lot, because that went to, like, number one worldwide highest grossing R-rated movie of all time when that came out, right in the, like, right before I think they started actually filming this movie. So but yeah, so the studio gave him all of that as long as they could lower his budget and then they could take money out of Hugh Jackman's salary, and everyone agreed. And they started filming this movie in 2016, and it released March 3rd, 2017. Let's talk about it. I don't think I've gone first for a while for initial thoughts, so I'll go first. And I'll say I absolutely love this movie. I think it is very, very close to a perfect movie. I have small gripes that take me out of it a little bit. That we'll talk about in the plot just a bit, but, like, the Wolverine's my favorite superhero. The X-Men are my favorite, like, superhero group of all time. And so this is obviously pitched right up my alley. And I love a good redemption story as well as, like, a story where the hero dies at the end. So, like, all of this is just completely pitched down the middle right at me. And yeah, I mean, I just think it's such a good way to give the Wolverine hope again, like give him a reason to kind of get back into the action. It doesn't feel like, I don't know, it doesn't feel like it's just being made for the sake of like, let's make another Wolverine movie. Like, this movie is saying something and it serves a purpose. And especially like, I think 2017 is like one of Marvel's weakest years, but like for this to come out in the middle of the MCU just absolutely dominating the superhero conversation, and be as excellent as it is, I think, really says something about like the production of this movie. And to know that like all of that came from Mangold, like no longer was the studio interfering on this, basically, like he got to do what he needed to do. And he even said, like, in this interview I listened to, he said, like, I was just so excited to be on this set and have to deal with like movie problems and like have to deal with, you know, Daphne Keene's child acting hours and like having to deal with, oh, our set like got rained on or whatever. And not having to deal with like studio issues and like making sure, you know, that I'm giving reverence to the storyline or whatever. And he was like, it just felt so good to be making a movie again. And I think it shows, like, I think this movie is extremely good. So, Brian, you want to go next? Just initial thoughts?
Yeah. I'm with you. I think I might, if the Nolan Batman trilogy doesn't exist, this might be the best superhero movie of all time to me. Like, I mean, it's a comic book movie or whatever. I don't know what the
right, whatever you
proper
call
term is. Sorry for the offense that I've caused. But no, the I mean, this is a, like, this is kind of a Mount Rushmore movie, I think, for the genre of film. And you can definitely tell that, I mean, I don't know all those things that you just said as far as, like, the pre-production and stuff. But, like, could it probably guess that some of it, I mean, it definitely, this definitely feels like a director making the movie that he wants to make. And that doesn't always go well. I mean, we talk about that all the time on our shows. Like, passion projects are real hit or miss, man. I mean, it's you get some really good ones, and then sometimes it's like, oh, okay, well, you probably should have let somebody interfere with that. But this one, it so perfectly encapsulates the character and the vibe that we're going for. It's so. I mean, there's very few movies that, beyond superhero movies, comic book movies, that there are so few movies that are able to have equal parts darkness and hope and have those things kind of going head to head, you know, butting heads for the, like, a good chunk of the movie, and have both sides of it feel organic and authentic to the movie and to the characters and stuff. And so to have, I mean, Professor X being so broken, that was hard. That's harder for me than Logan until right towards the very end. Like, just seeing Charles in that state is really difficult, I think. And to have him, like, just trying so hard to go to bat for Laura and just having so much hope in what she can be and what the future of mutant kind is and stuff, in the midst of everything that's going on, and Logan just kind of wanting to die but not quite being able to yet, is really, I mean, it's just kind of remarkable. It's really great storytelling. And anyway, I just, it's very uncommon to see a movie that does try to have both of those contrasting aspects and then is able to do them both very, very well. And so to do that in through the medium of a superhero movie is crazy. I mean, that's the degree of difficulty on that is like impossible. And it's just so, it's so well done. And so anyway, you have three great performances and then a bunch of really good, I think, side performances as well. And it's a, I'm with you. There's like maybe one or two things like that are a little bit down maybe compared to the rest of it, but it's like, well, that's a 9 and everything else is a 10. So right. It's still a pretty great movie. And it's Yeah, it's one that I've watched a ton of times. I'll definitely throw it on in the background when I'm working on stuff. But I will find myself getting kind of sucked into it, especially down the stretch as it gets through that third act, because I just think it's a really powerful movie. And
yeah,
and it's cool that I'm older than you guys. And so, I mean, you know, I remember like, you know, Batman Forever, you know what I mean? So it's like, that was in theaters. And it's just funny it's cool that we live in a world where you can make a comic book movie that is such a, like a borderline, like important movie. I think it's just, it's really great.
Yeah.
It's a really great film.
Sure. Paige?
Ethan, I'm kind of the opposite of what you said, where you said that this movie lines up everything that you love and you would just expect to love it because of the content and the things that it's about and the way it's presented. You're like, oh yeah, I would love this movie. And I do. It's like the opposite for me because, well, kind of, but I hate violence so much. I don't like watching movies with any sort of violence. That's like my least favorite aspect of any movie. And I'm not the world's biggest superhero human. I have become more so since being with Ethan, but initially I never really, I watched Iron Man because it was on cable all the time, but that was about it. So I didn't care too much. But this movie does really work, and I don't know why, because I shouldn't like it, but I really do. I think I just admire the passion behind it from both the director and the performances. I think that it's very obvious that there is a lot of care and love that has gone into almost every single aspect of this movie. So from James Mangold and all the amazing choices he makes in this movie, the way it looks is unreal. I don't know. There's something about the way that this movie just comes together. It makes sense in my brain of like, yeah, you just watched a good movie. You didn't want to watch like 50% of it because he's slashing people's faces off, but you watched it and you loved it. So, yeah, I don't know. This is my second viewing, and I definitely am still as high as when I first saw it. So I think that, yeah, high quality movie. Not my type of movie. Not something I would ever pop on casually and watch in the background because it just freaked me out. But it's a good movie.
Well, let's talk about the cast a little bit. We can, you know, buzz through this or if we have any specific thoughts. First up, we got to talk about Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. And I think, you know, let's just lump him in. We'll say Patrick Stewart as Professor Xavier too, because I think that the power in these two performances for two people who have played these characters over the course of 17 years at this point. And, like, Hugh Jackman technically, I guess, has the Guinness World Record because he, like, comes in before Professor X and X-Men and then outlives him in this movie. but, like, both of them have been in, you know, almost all the X-Men movies up to this point. And I just think that, like, these characters are so lived in. They have so much emotion. And really, I think something that's very underlooked is just how much of a relationship these two have, because like in the very beginning of the movie, when they're going back and forth, you know, and like, you know, the first time I was in the theater watching this, I was like, Professor Xavier just told Wolverine to shut the fuck up. Like Jesus. And you know, like Brian says, some of that can get like a little eye rolly if they use it too much, but I think they use it like the perfect amount to just illustrate that, like, this is a guy, you know, Wolverine, who owes his life to Professor X. Professor X gave him a family, like gave him a home when he had nothing, like helped him get his memories back, did all this stuff. And now, you know, Professor X is essentially like a war hero, a war criminal, you know, and Wolverine just has to take care of him because he meant so much to him. And I think it's a really beautiful relationship, and I think both of them play it perfectly.
Yeah, like, to turn this movie into, like, a buddy movie, but then, like, the angriest buddy movie ever. I mean, it's a really bold stroke, especially when this is the only, the only like real R-rated movie within this universe. Like it's a, it's I mean it's again 100% works, but it is jarring the first time around when you hear Professor Charles just dog cuss Logan. You're like, whoa, man, like that's not talk that a professor. I mean, it's so strange. Having just spent, you know, like almost 30 years with this character, either in animated or live action form. And so, it's a pretty, it's a pretty bold choice to go that route, but the two of them just work so, so beautifully together. And there's a real family vibe to it. And in the best and worst ways, like what family can be. And that's, I don't know. I'm a big sucker for adopted families and, you know, mentor, mentee.
It's like the heart kinda, of the X-Men.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I'm a real big sucker for that kind of stuff. There's no, I joke all the time about like, I will cry in any movie. There's no, you know, there's almost no way to get me going quicker than like some sort of, a father figure or mother figure type character like that. And so anyway, like to get the family aspect of this, the kind of the hard parts of being in a family and establishing early on the side effects that the dementia essentially that that Charles is suffering from and how hard that is on Logan. And it does such a great job of establishing the family dynamic. And again, that's like, you know, you almost like take a step back and be like, this is a comic book movie. Like this is such a, such a strange departure from what we are used to with most of these kinds of movies. So anyway, the dynamic between the two of them is fantastic. And it is very easy to like, to sort of plant this in your brain and then like have confirmation bias on it. But it very much feels like both of these actors who are both, you know, extremely talented actors saying, this is the last time I'm going to embody this character and I'm going to give it every single thing that I have. And that is, I don't know, there's something special about that.
Yeah, for sure. I think too, and I'm going to peel back the curtain maybe a little too far, but like their relationship is so true to life because like my grandpa just passed away this year. And like we had a very like, he was my hero, you know, he was like one of the best people in my life, like he took care of me. And then he had a stroke I can't even remember how long ago now, like almost a decade ago. And he lost the ability to use like the left side of his body. He couldn't talk anymore. And there's like that level of like, okay, you are still the same person, but then also things are different. And then like there is, you know, for the person who's like helping take care of them, there's that frustration and still like you're still reverent, like you still love them. And I think this movie just really hits that on the nose perfectly. Like someone involved has been through that, like almost has to be, because it feels so true to life.
Yeah, 100%. It's to get that aspect so, I think, spot on from my own experiences, you know, like I'm blown away by, both of my grandparents passed within about 6 months of each other in 2018, and very selfishly, I'm glad that I did not see this movie. This movie was not coming out like while I was going through all that, because it would have been, I mean, that's, it's really, it's, I don't know. I mean, it's a real authentic, I think very true to life experience. I don't know. I've said previously, like I went to see Coco, Thanksgiving break, you know, and like the day after Thanksgiving, and my grandparents were both here at the house, and neither of them made it to the next Thanksgiving. And it was like, as I was going to see Coco, you know, as I'm in Coco and my grandparents are at my house and just having seen their decline and stuff and being like, well, this is going to make me, I'm going to cry for 4 days. Like, this is the, you know, this is the best worst and all that.
I was
like,
going to say, I saw Coco and I cried for 4 days.
Yeah.
And I still had on my grandma. You
know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
they were
just,
still good at that point.
It is brutal. But this, I mean, it's maybe not to the level of Pixar, but that would, I mean, maybe that just means James Mangold isn't a masochist. But like the dynamic between those two characters is fantastic. Just really fantastic. Yeah.
And then, you know, the last little leg of the triangle here, we got Daphne Keene as Laura. So, like, James Mangold said he basically, like, had the narrowest little casting window because, like, this character had to, like, he said whoever played this role had to be, like, proficient in martial arts, had to be bilingual, had to be Latina, she had to be, you know, age 10 to 12, and... like had just the strictest casting things of all time. And he said like they were really struggling to find people. And then Daphne Keene's father is an actor named Will Keene, who's been on like a bunch of British TV shows. And he like sent in a tape of his daughter just like climbing up like sofas and like dressers and like jumping off of them and basically acting like a little savage. And he said like as soon as he saw that video, he knew that it had to be Daphne Keene. And he also said like she's just incredible. Like she listens, you know, when you tell her like acting things. And he said like sometimes with kids, like you start to get like – at near the end, you're just like, okay, stand there, look this way. And every time Daphne Keene would be like, what's my character feeling? Like, what emotion should I be portraying in this? And he's like, she just has such like a complex acting persona already for being like 12 years old at this point.
She could be in a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Throw her on in.
But yeah, so I think like, and, you know, James Mangold also said, like, he wasn't allowed to tell people that this character was going to be X-23, so they had to be, like, real hush-hush with the casting process and all that. But, like, I think she absolutely kills it for a kid actor. Like, we have seen a lot of, like, make-or-break kid actor performances in our movies, and some that are just passable, some that are really good. And, like, I put this as, like, maybe one of the best kid performances I've ever seen.
Yeah, I thought she should have been nominated for an Oscar this year, honestly. I mean, I'm
absolutely
kind of not kidding. I mean, she's so good. And it's how many movies have you seen that have gotten sunk by even mediocre kid actors? I mean, it's
absolutely
just, it's really difficult. And then to add the physical aspect of that to this movie, I mean, come on. Like this is a crazy performance.
She also doesn't talk for like half the movie and still portrays so much emotion and change without words. It's unreal. Yeah, she's
absolutely
great.
For sure.
All right, let's just round out the cast real quick. We got Stephen Merchant as Caliban. Very odd. They like recast this character because it was played by a guy named Tomas Lemarquis in X-Men Apocalypse. And so they were like, oh, we want Caliban in this, but we're going to make it Stephen Merchant. But like, I think it's a really good performance as well from Stephen Merchant. Like, I think, you know, sadly, he gets sidelined for, like, a lot of this movie. And I don't think that they could, but, like, one of Caliban's powers in the comics is, like, the more fear that he senses, like, the stronger he gets. And I've always really liked the character. So, like, it is a bummer that they just turn him, like, just into the tracking mutants part. But I think it's a good performance. And then, like, the other two side characters are Boyd Holbrook plays Pierce, like, the head of the Reavers, who is hunting down X-23. And then Richard E. Grant plays Dr. Rice, kind of the big behind-the-scenes bad guy. And I think both of them are menacing. You know, I think they do the job well. Richard E. Grant especially just, like, has that vibe, I feel like, where, like, if he is playing sinister, like, he's going to kill it. And I really like the choice of having, like, Pierce be this huge X-Men fan, basically. Like, even though he's at odds with these characters, like, he just loves the idea of seeing Wolverine and, like, Professor X. Like, he's just so excited by that and so familiar that I think it makes, like, a very personal connection with them despite their limited shared time on screen.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about any of those three guys?
No.
I think right. that, I mean, if I'm usually one who's like, we need this movie should be shorter. I probably could have used more of Richard E. Grant's character. Like, that could have been
sure.
developed out into an extra 15 minutes, honestly, and I'd probably be okay with it. Because it does kind of come out of nowhere, like, what you get, like, that his sort of bad guy monologue, in a way. Towards the end.
Yeah, right at the end where he's like, I caused all of this to happen. And you're like, oh, you did? Oh.
Right, you're like, oh, it's okay, all right. And I forget about that. Like, watching it for this episode, I when that part happened, I was like, all right, I forgot that there's this whole, like, I mean, there's a huge backstory here that we're just kind of barely scraping the surface of. But Richard E. Grant's really good. So that would have been, I could use maybe a little more of that. I think Boyd Holbrook is great in this too. And he's kind of hit or miss at times, looking at you, the Predator. But the he does the sort of seediness really well. Like, he just, there's that kind of, his character is like super dirty and shady, and he embodies that in this role very well. He may be a very nice man in person, I don't know, but he does this thing I think very, very well. And that's not always easy to do. It's not even an uber charisma role. It's just like, he's sort of menacing just in his presence, but he's not like overpoweringly so anyway. I think it's kind of an interesting performance that would get a lot more buzz if there weren't four other characters that were obsessed with and like really into what they're doing. Like, it's a really
absolutely
a little more of a nuanced performance than it probably gets credit for.
Yeah. There's definitely, just to circle back to Richard E. Grant for a second, but like when Wolverine's like watching the video on the phone that's like explaining Laura's backstory, there's definitely a moment every time where I'm like, oh, right, Richard E. Grant's in this, because he like shows up in the background of the video for 1 second. And I'm like, oh, right, we'll check back in with him in like an hour.
Sure.
Good. Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into the plot. Before we talk about the plot, Paige will give us a 10-word plot summary. No more, no less. 10 words, exactly the plot of Logan.
All right. Logan. Damaged hero learns to save himself by finding true purpose.
There you go. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, I don't know how many specific scenes you guys want to talk about. There's one in particular that I really want to touch on. But, like, the plot of this movie, you know, Wolverine and Professor X and Caliban are, like, hiding out in Mexico. Professor X has dementia. It is, like, heavily, heavily hinted at that Professor X, like, when he loses control of his dementia, basically just, like, stops time, like psychic feedback stops time for everyone around them, but they like can't breathe, and so if it goes on for long enough, they will all die. And it is heavily hinted that he essentially killed the rest of the X-Men at some point, everyone besides Wolverine, I would say. And they are just trying to scrape enough money together to be able to escape and make it to, like, a boat that Wolverine and Professor X can get on and go out in the middle of the ocean where, you know, Professor X can't bother anyone anymore. And I think, like you said, Brian, like, this is not at all where I expected this movie to start. You know, being a huge fan of the Old Man Logan, like, comic book, I wasn't sure exactly what we were going to get, but it definitely wasn't, like, geriatric Professor Xavier and then like Wolverine driving a limo around. But I also think it's a very interesting place to start the story, because it's like, yeah, this is, you know, I think they say it's like 2029 or something. So they're like, yeah, this is like the future and it's crummy, but only like kind of crummy. Like, it's not, you know, a wasteland. It's just like, capitalism probably got a little out of control and that's where we're at.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love that. I mean, I'm a big fan of sci-fi, near sci-fi that like has right. just enough advancement and also de-advancement. What's the, I don't know, whatever, to where you feel like you're in a different world, but it feels so relevant or familiar at the same time. I love, like, Looper, I think, does that really well, where it's like, it's just like a Dodge Ram with some kind of different engine strapped to it is basically right. what it is, you know, things like that. I think are pretty cool. But yes, it's a good, that's like the perfect number of years to advance, I think, for this plot line.
Yeah, for sure. And then, I mean, pretty much, you know, there's a lot of character moments, I would say, that we won't necessarily talk about, but like, it's a very meditative movie, and there's a lot of like banter back and forth between, you know, Wolverine and Caliban and Wolverine and Professor X, where like you just realize how kind of miserable life is for these guys now that Professor X has been deemed like a weapon of mass destruction and they have to be constantly on the run from the government. But then we meet Laura, and then her caretaker is Elizabeth Rodriguez, plays Gabriella, like her caretaker. And Wolverine agrees to take them to North Dakota, but Gabriella is murdered by Pierce before that can happen. And there's this big, you know, fight and all that before Wolverine, Professor X, and Laura set off on their journey together. I will say, I every single time forget, like, the scene where she's in the steel mill, the soldiers go in. You know, there's like the kind of generic, like screaming and yelling in the building. You know, it's a little like I've seen it done a hundred times, but it's so great when she walks out and she's holding something. And every time I forget what it is, and every time she flops the head down, I'm like, right, so great.
Yeah, she super murdered all those guys. Like,
not just kind of. Yeah, she really got them. Right.
It is another like establishing moment for the movie, because like you get, I mean, right off the bat with Wolverine just going ham on those guys that try to kill him and stuff. So you get the sort of like, hey, this is what the violence is going to be like in this thing. But when she comes out with the head again, it's like, oh right, this is not like X2 or something. Like, this is a different kind of movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like I said, I just think it's a lot of fun that like Pierce is very excited to see Professor Xavier, and he's like, I know you guys are like the people I'm trying to hunt, but like, can I just talk to Professor Xavier for a little bit? Like, I don't know. I find that very interesting. And Caliban's captured by these guys so that he can continue to track them. And of course, like, Professor X is also having this conversation with Laura all mentally, about how she's like the new great hope for the mutant race. And eventually, you know, we come to find out that she's like made from Logan's DNA. And I do think like the choice, so X-23 in the comics has always kind of come out as like 18 pretty much. And like, that's when the X-Men always first discover her. She's usually like an adult or kind of like a young adult. And I really love X-23 like as a character in the comics. And she, it's basically like, in a lot of ways, not just power wise, but they get to redo Wolverine's character arc like for the modern generation in a lot of ways, because she's like, starts off as a savage killing machine, and then like, it gives Wolverine someone to mentor and like bring back into the world. And but like, James Mangold's decision to have her be like a small child just brings so much more heart to this character. Like, I think it would be a lot harder to buy this movie if it was like, oh, even if it was like, oh, here's 16-year-old X-23, you know, like, I just don't think the movie works in the same way. It, 'cause we have to believe that she is not, indoctrinated, like that she has still child left in her and like hope left in her in order for this movie to work, I think. But then to see the contrast of like this child do like a scissor kick and slice a guy's throat open with her toe claw is also like very good. But as you know, Wolverine, Xavier, and Laura flee, they eventually end up in Oklahoma City, where they get like a hotel room. And this is when, I mean, the big like Xavier breakdown scene happens, and this is maybe my favorite. This is like definitely my favorite scene in the whole movie. It might be one of my favorite superhero scenes of all time. But just like,
you do pump your fists when he's going through the
yeah, you
the
have
hotel
to.
Stabbing people and
well, and it's just so funny because like you would think in a movie like this, like you would want to see like the John Wick hallway fight, right, where he's like it's one shot, he's just beating up all these people, and like instead this movie says like all of the enemies are going to be frozen and Wolverine is just barely going to be able to drag himself down this hallway to like try and give Professor X a shot, but the whole time he's doing it he's also slowly stabbing dudes in the head. And like I just think it's such an interesting choice to take what could have been like just another big action scene and give it like really slow it down and give it weight. And it's also like the first time really that Wolverine and Laura have like worked together. And I think there was a fact about how they did that I'm gonna try and look up, but yeah, I just thought, I think this scene is incredible and I love watching it so much.
It's a great action scene, and I'm not somebody who gets, like, action scenes are cool, at least fight scenes. I mean, I'm mostly only interested in action scenes that involve like dragging a bank vault through the streets of Rio or something like that. Like that's the stuff that I remember. When people discredit a movie or complain about a movie because the action's bad, I'm usually like, okay, that's fine. I didn't really notice that, or I wasn't really paying attention all that much to that. Especially something that I'm like watching at home. It's like, okay, cool, that's fine. But this is like one of the real memorable ones from this genre of film, I think, because the slow-mo does something, but that's, or it's not slow-mo, but the fighting through the mutant resistance thing that he's doing and stuff is it. That could be kind of a MacGuffin or a bit really easily. Right. But instead it like, no, that makes sense. Like it makes sense that the most powerful mutant ever is doing this and no one can fight through it except this dude whose bones are coated in adamantium and is like just, you know, his whole bit is being super determined and impossible to take down and that kind of stuff. So it's a very effective sequence, and it uses the concept I think really, really well. Really well.
Yeah. Especially like, you know, there's the one where he first gets to the hotel room and he's like clawing along the wall.
Yeah. And that guy's like trying to get away, like, oh no.
Yeah, like, you just see the eyes like slide to Wolverine. Yeah. It's so great. So apparently how they did that was they shot wider than was needed and then like shaky cam. And then in post, they went back and they tried to like stabilize it. And it just made for that like weird kind of disorienting effect that I think is super effective is the word I'm looking for. Yeah, so after they get away from that, Wolverine, Xavier, and Laura end up helping some farmers on the road. This is another one of those scenes where it's like, now we're going to get into a little bit about like how the world is bad, because like trucks are just driving themselves and they're owned by corporations so they can be programmed to like run people off the road. And they help these farmers. They get invited back to like the family's farmhouse. And while they're there, you know, Wolverine helps, like, the dad, who's played by Eric LaSalle, and the mom's played by Elise Neal, and, like, they go out and they help him with, like, these crop people who have bought up all the farmlands around them to grow corn for sugary drinks and whatnot. And this is where I think maybe my biggest problem with the movie shows up, is I just get a little disinterested when the big physical threat is just, like, another Wolverine. Because for all of the things that this movie does to shake, like, the comic book movie stereotypes, there's nothing more generic to me than just, like, hero fights another version of themselves. Like, whether it's, sure, you know, Venom and Carnage, or you know, Spider-Man and Venom, you know, Wolverine and Sabretooth, even, like, even though, you know, like, I just think that, like, I know that you can't have Logan and Boy, you know, Logan and Pierce fight hand to hand, because that ends very quickly, as we find out in all the other action scenes where Logan fights anyone who's not, like, a mutant. But still, like, it just sucks me out of it to see, like, bad guy Hugh Jackman. And I get, like, all of the themes of it, where it's like, oh, he has to, like, kill the savage side of himself to be able to rest and all that, but it still just drags me out just a little bit.
Well, how, even themes feel? Aside, it's still kind of lame. I don't know. Well, he's not even like a villain necessarily, because he's just programmed to do this act of murdering, mm-hmm, Wolverine. So I wouldn't even call him, like, a villain with malicious intent. But it just sucks that the threat is something that doesn't feel creative, and it doesn't feel threatening. I don't know. I like you said, like, Pierce is more threatening as a presence than this kill machine. So I think that there is some disconnect there between trying to build up something that never built to be quite as scary as it maybe aimed to be, if that makes sense.
I think movies too often are too heavy-handed with metaphor and allegory and stuff like that, but this is one that I think actually could have used a little bit. Because this is my complaint as well, Ethan. You mentioned, sure, at the top, this was your, you have an issue. This is mine as well. Like, if this is not a perfect movie, then this is the flaw for me. And it feels like there's an Empire Strikes Back, Luke fighting Vader in the Dagobah cave thing here,
yeah,
somewhere, that gets a little bit, I won't even say lost in translation, but, like, you almost want to be like, you could have gone a little heavier on that and given us something that brings home the concept of Wolverine fighting himself. Right. That would have been a little bit more, I think, fitting for what this movie does on so many other levels. Would have fit really well, and to your point, Paige, would have made it less of a killing machine type thing that's not really very interesting. I actually like Rabid Wolverine robot killing machine thing in the last, at the end, like in the final battle. I think it's pretty, right, cool. But in this, this part, and I don't know what the answer is, so I hate having a criticism and not providing, right, a solution. Because you have to, I mean, the Professor X death,
oh yeah,
has to happen, and that is a heartbreaking, vital part of this movie, and so that has to go through. So there has to be a whole rewrite if you're not going to bring that clone Logan into the fray. At this point, you got to figure out something else, and I don't have a great solution for that, and so maybe that's the whole point. I don't know, but you're right. Like, it's been done several times. I wonder if I would dislike this or kind of meh it if Wolverine Origins didn't exist when he fights Ryan Reynolds at the end, and it's kind of the exact same thing, you know?
Right,
So maybe I wouldn't have the same... Because I do remember watching this the first time and being like, that's exactly what happens in X-Men Origins, and that's not a very good movie, you know? So it's just kind of a strange... it's a strange one for Mangold to go with, I think. I think it all makes sense in the end. So if this is the only way that we can get to that point at the end of it, then okay, that's like a, to me, it's like a, that's a small criticism that I can get with, or I can get over pretty easily, but I am the same way. Right. It's like, this just feels like, I think you're spot on, Paige. Like, he's not really a villain. He's just like a robot, and it's not very, compelling. The metaphor is compelling, or the allegory or whatever it is. I don't know. My English teacher's going to be angry at me, but the, that stuff is interesting, but it doesn't quite come home the way that I think it probably needs to for that whole sequence to be like kind of perfect.
Yeah, and I think on some level it almost, for a movie that I think has a very careful control over its emotional balance at all times, like when Dark Wolverine kills Professor X, and you just get that moment where you're like, oh, he literally was just telling him, like, I know that I killed all the X-Men. And then it's like, meh, you're dead. It's such a downer that, like, mm-hmm. I think maybe part of it, too, is that the movie loses for me a little bit of that balance. And I start to sink too much into, like, that was brutally sad, especially mm-hmm. because, you know, Dark Wolverine murders this whole farmer family that was really nice as well. So, like, yeah. And I think I agree with you, Brian, that, like, when he shows back up at the end of the movie, it's good thematically. It's still, like, not quite my favorite, but I think it's better than this scene. I think, like, just the conclusion to the farmhouse stuff is maybe the biggest drag point of the movie for me. But yeah, so with Professor X dead and buried, we find out that Laura can actually talk this whole time. And they eventually make it to Eden, which is where all of Laura's, like, friends from this Mexican lab where they were being, like, raised as little assassins have gotten, so that they can get across the border into Canada, which is, like, a safe haven for mutants, apparently. And while they're there, basically just a lot of character moments between Logan and Laura. But the gist of it is Logan gets given this, like, medication so that he can restore his mutant powers. And Laura tries to make him come with them, but he, like, basically refuses, which pisses her off. And then he falls asleep, wakes up the next morning. They're already gone, but he realizes that the Reavers are following them through the woods. And then this is, like, easily the other part where I'm pumping my fists in the movie. Like, watching... Well, because one of the best things about any X-Men movie is just watching people use all these different superpowers, right? And especially in a movie like this where it's not, like... You know, this isn't Cyclops and Nightcrawler and Gambit and Rogue. You know, these aren't, like, powers that I know in my head. And so, like, each kid that gets focused on, I'm like, what's this kid gonna do? And it's like, oh, they're gonna stab this person 500 times with pine needles. Like, sounds good.
Yeah.
You know, like, but even through all that, when Wolverine takes the full dose of the medication, and then you're just watching these kids run through the forest, and then you hear just the guttural scream of Wolverine, I'm like, hell yes. Like, I'm so and then he, you know, bursts onto the scene like a superhero. I love it so much.
First of all, I would watch an entire movie of just montages of like teenage mutants showing off whatever power they're discovering. Absolutely. I love that in every single one of these movies, even the crappy ones. I think it's so cool when they show just like, oh, that guy has ice, and oh, this. I mean, I love it. I love it every time.
Even the beginning of X-Men Origins Wolverine when the team like infiltrates the building.
100%.
Like, even though I think they're all kind of crummy actors, like it's still fun to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Best part of the Suicide Squad that I just watched.
Sure, sure.
Like, I love that stuff. I think it's, I will always, it's just, I don't know. It's so cool with these movies, especially, or like these, it's not cool with Batman. We know what Batman does, you know? Like, it's just, I don't know. I love it. I love it when they do that. So, big fan. And should always be a part of any X-Men movie, I think. But, yeah, like, that's, I mean, that feels, well, this movie came out in, what, 2017? So this feels like 17 years of, like, pent-up aggression coming out on the screen. And you're just like, finally, he is like, unleashed and is just going berserk. And I don't know, it's hard not to get pumped up, even knowing in the moment. I don't know if you guys had this experience, but first time around, as I'm watching this movie, I'm like, he's going to die. He is not getting out of this.
Yeah.
And this is going to be devastating at the end of it. But even still, you're like, yes, this is so cool. Like, this guy is just, he is, all of these people are about to die because they're bad. And he has had it. And he just took like a mega Red Bull into his veins, and he's like just ready to go. And it's, I don't know. It feels, like I said, it feels like the culmination of this character, which I know that it is, but in the moment, first time around, you're like, oh my gosh, this is everything that we have been building towards with this particular character for 9 movies or whatever it was at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I will say is I did, especially at the end of this, I think, get a little bit annoyed with James Mangold, like, not trusting his audience again. And we talked about it a lot last week, with the Wolverine, because they would be like, oh, Wolverine's going to this palace. I wonder what he's going to find. Oh, we found the plans for the Silver Samurai armor. Well, wonder what's going to be at the palace. You know, like, whereas, like, right here at the end, I think, you know, I think context clues tell you that Wolverine's definitely, like, if you've watched a movie before, you know Wolverine's going down here. But then, like, also they're like, oh, here's this medication. Don't take it all at once or else you'll probably die. But we're going to leave you the whole bottle right here. But then also with there's been this like through line with the adamantium bullet where like first Caliban found it and Wolverine's like, oh, you know, I just keep that to remind me of the old days. And then later, like when they're at Eden, Laura finds it and Wolverine's like, well, I was probably going to kill myself because like that can do it. And so then in this final scene, you know, with Dark Wolverine, you know that he has to be shot with the bullet if you're paying attention at all to the movie. But like they show the gun on the ground, they show her like grab the bullet, and then they show the gun on the ground again, like as she picks it up. And I'm like, OK, James, I get it. She's going to shoot him in the head. I understand with the adamantium bullet, like you can let it go. But again, I mean, that's such a minor gripe in this movie that I'm having such a good time with, especially because, you know, Wolverine's going nuts. And then, he gets stabbed onto like a log, which is brutal. And, that is going to be it for Wolverine. But, a lot of people have pointed out, and I do find it quite, nice that in the Wolverine, his partner, whose name currently escapes me from that movie, said that she had foreseen his death where he was going to die, with his chest cut open and holding his heart in his hand. And like at the end of this movie, when he's got the giant wound in his chest and he's just holding Daphne Keene, and then he's like, you know, don't be what they made you to be. And then she just says like, daddy, like, oh my God, it's so soul crushing. Like, it's just so good. Mm. And then of course, like as if I wasn't already crying by this point, like in the theater, when they make the grave for him, you know, she repeats the lines from Shane, like the Western that they were watching earlier, which again, like, great moment. I always love stuff like that, where like they put stuff on TV for a character to watch and then they repeat it later. I don't know why, but and then when she picks up the fucking cross and she puts it down on the ground as an X, like, it just absolutely murders me every time. And I think, you know, we got very biblical with the Rank Kings on our 310 to Yuma episode, because I think there's a lot of allegories there. But like, this is almost, I think, James Mangold being like, Wolverine is not a Jesus figure, like, but he is an X-Men. Like, here, you know, this is his legacy. Everything that these people stood for, you know, protecting the innocent, and he may be the last X-Men, but like, he, you know, that was who Wolverine was. And I just love it. I mean, it's literally putting to bed like this character that has been in movies for 17 years. Like, it's just incredible. And yeah.
Yeah, that scene gushing,
but I won't.
Is just is brutal. I always forget that she calls him daddy too, and it just oh my gosh, just guts me every single time. So that's fun to go through. But the whole sequence is spot on. It is fitting. That's how he should die. It's how he should die.
Right.
And I just love that that Mangold understands the character and knows that there can't be that's Wolverine's version of a happy ending. There isn't a better ending for him than that. And so, I don't know. I'm a big fan of writers and directors recognizing and understanding how their characters should end or continue or whatever, you know, that to for know sure. that there's there can be, it can be fitting without being happy, or it can be happy without being smiley. I don't know how to put that, but like, that's how he should die. There's right. No other way. For if it had gone any other way, you probably feel, you might still walk out and be like, man, that was a great movie, but you're gonna feel a little cheated if then it cuts to the credits or something and they're like,
and the
driving
dust rises,
yeah, exactly,
coffin,
yeah, like, and they're like
Batman v Superman.
Yeah, he's like in the backseat of the car while she drives through like Saskatchewan or something. I mean, it's like, right. it wouldn't work. Like, that's how it had to be. And I love and respect that Mangold shows how much he understood that character and what needed to happen.
Paige, you love when characters die at the end of the movie. Do you have any thoughts?
I do love when main characters die at the end of the movie. I mean, they killed like all of them in this movie, so I guess I should be really happy. everyone essentially just dies. So, except for the farmers, not a fan of them dying, but everyone else dying.
They didn't deserve it.
Cherry on top for me.
And just a heartbreaking moment. I mean, we skimmed over it at the time, but like, I forgot that how they get out of like Dark Wolverine at the farmer's house is that Eric LaSalle like gets in his car, runs over Dark Wolverine, like, you know, pins him to the fence and then shoots him 3 times with a shotgun and then turns around and tries to shoot Wolverine. And it just like breaks my heart every time that, you know, this guy is so betrayed in his final moments by like something that Wolverine had no control over. But
yeah.
Again, that's just the Wolverine character. Like, he can never, it's like you said, Brian, like, he has to die, and he has to die like this because he can't ever have a happy life. That's just not reality for Wolverine.
Right.
Any last thoughts about the movie plot-wise?
I do love that he kills Richard E. Grant's character the way he does. Like, that's so shocking, you know, just like, oh right. Dang, he just full-on shot that dude. I mean, it's awesome. I mean, it's awesome. It's very extremely effective in that moment,
right? And by comparison, I'm not a huge fan of the way that Boyd Holbrook dies, because it's like, it's kind of the cheesy moment where like all the kids get one use of their power on him. And I'm like, okay, like I get why you do it, but I think give him a little better death than that. But that's, again, these are small nitpicks for a movie that I genuinely love. So
sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the reception. So this made $619 million on a budget of $127 million. And it made more in its first 2 weeks than The Wolverine did in its entire box office run. So even though it was R-rated, like, people just poured out for this movie. At the time, it was the number six highest grossing R-rated movie worldwide, which is really impressive. And it gained a large critical reception, has like a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I think that, you know, this movie came out in like March, but already I think there was some buzz for like, is this going to be the first superhero movie to get nominated for Best Picture? Is this going to be like Patrick Stewart, you know, Hugh Jackman? Like, are they going to have Oscar runs this year? And I almost wonder, I mean, you know, and then Black Panther comes along next year and gets the Best Picture nominee. But like, I wonder if Logan came out in like October, if that's a world that we could see. And it's hard because I do think that like 2017 is one of the most stacked movie years of all time, in my opinion, like that certainly that I've lived through. My top 10 for 2017 is like a absolute bloodbath, because even though I love Logan, I have it as number five overall for 2017. So like I could easily see, you know, why it got boxed out in a weaker year. It could have been possible, I would say.
Yeah, 2017 is a banger, and so that's a tough one. I do think if it had been October instead of March, I don't know if it would have happened, but it would have generated more. It would have had a better chance of getting something for Stewart or Jackman. But yes, like,
well, I think certainly Patrick Stewart, because like, I don't know, Christopher Plummer for All the Money in the World, I don't know if that's really the nomination that we needed that year. But also, like, I am not a big fan of Three Billboards, and Sam Rockwell winning for Three Billboards has me scratching my head a little bit. And I definitely don't think that both he and Woody Harrelson necessarily needed to be nominated that year. But it also doesn't matter, because the greatest Best Supporting Actor performance that I've seen probably ever is also nominated, which is Willem Dafoe in The Florida Project. So, you know, I know you're not a big fan of that one.
Yeah, I don't like The Florida Project, but he's good in that.
I think he's incredible.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's sufficiently not creepy, which is weird. But,
which is incredible for Willem Dafoe. I mean,
that's true. You should probably give him an Oscar for not being a creepy weirdo. It definitely, you could, I would think that if Fox had this one to do over again, you definitely push that to October and try to get some nominations out of it, and might have worked out. I mean, Christopher Plummer got it because of the way that role came about, you know, with the Kevin Spacey thing and everything, but
sure.
It's fine. I don't remember. I love Richard Jenkins. I don't remember him in Shape of Water at all. Like at all.
I think he's so great in that movie.
Okay. I can't remember anything about that movie except for the obviously the fish sex. But,
sure.
But you're probably right.
I would definitely lock in Jenkins and Dafoe for sure. Okay. At least for me, for my five.
Yeah. I mean, you're probably right. One of those Rockwell or Harrelson. I like that movie quite a bit, but probably one of them would maybe not. I mean, I certainly would have had these two in my rankings that year if I had been, you know, so lucky as to receive a vote. But it is, look.
And like, this is another beating where it's like Best Actor also went to Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour, which I'm sure he's great in, but like the rest of the category I think is so much more interesting than that like.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, I think that's a well-deserved Oscar, but also is another one where you can say it's partly the process of Gary Oldman might be the greatest actor of his generation, and he's not yet received an Oscar, so we have to...
Absolutely.
We have to do something. But yes, when you're looking at this count this year, and it's like, Get Out, Dunkirk, Logan, The Big Sick, Lady Bird, I, Tonya, Disaster Artist, yep. And then the movies that actually won things, like Shape of Water and Three Billboards, and Phantom Thread is in this. I mean, that's like a... That's a crazy, crazy stacked year.
Absolutely.
And you could, and you know, Baby Driver's great, Kevin Spacey aside, and well, the Post was getting good.
That's
vibes,
suddenly
and,
the most cursed movie of all time, I know, but seriously. I still love it.
Yeah,
but.
same. So I mean, there's just it was a tough year for a comic book movie to try to kind of break the curse right. And all this stuff.
But it was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, which is the first superhero movie to ever be nominated for Adapted Screenplay, and only the second after Incredibles to be nominated for Screenplay at all. Against Molly's Game, Mudbound, The Disaster Artist, and Call Me By Your Name, which is what eventually won. And I did just want to highlight that Daphne Keane got like a ton of little award nominations at like all the different award shows, including she got the last Best Female Newcomer Award at the Empire Awards show before they stopped doing that. So that's pretty cool for her. And then, you know, she went on to get His Dark Materials, like that Amazon series. And I think she won a pretty major award for that. Now I can't remember off the top of my head, but seems to still be killing it. So
yeah,
do you guys
good start.
Yeah. Do you guys have any themes or lessons that we haven't already touched on that you want to get out of the way before we end this thing?
I think a big one is just coming to terms with death. I think death is just a big theme in this. Not just because, you know, everyone dies, but Wolverine mentions multiple times throughout the movie, you know, oh, I was planning to kill myself, you know. It's very obvious that there's nothing he finds worth living for, and that in his moment when it is his time, he finds that, you know, there was something that he never knew he could even have, and that makes his death peaceful, as opposed to what he thought he wanted before with his death. So, yeah. Fun themes.
A lot of sunshine and rainbows here. I think I kind of mentioned it previously, the whole the father figure thing, the mentor mentee, all that. It's like the sort of the cycle of parenting, the circle of parenting, because he's sitting here in the middle of seeing his father die in a really terrible way. Not that there's ever a great way to watch your parent or your father figure die, but like, that like whole the dementia thing is just brutal, and to see that unfolding, and then at the same time he's the father for this child who is him. You know, it's like kind of a obviously a younger, wild version of himself, and to see how he's like kind of trying to bridge the gap between those two roles is really powerful, and it makes you sit back and just be like, how is this a comic book movie? I mean, this is just,
for sure,
it's amazing what he's able. I mean, how many like indie dramas are trying to do this and are failing comparatively to what this movie's doing? And by the way, in the middle of all this, he's like throat ripping dudes, you know? So it's a crazy, crazy accomplishment to pull that off with the level of quality that the movie has.
Yeah, for sure. I think as far as like the James Mangold storyline, I do think, like we talked about last week, this is kind of the perfected version of the themes that he was going for in the Wolverine and the story that he was trying to tell with that. Like, it just gets to be so much more fleshed out. And it does, because he also got to put an end to this character. Like, if Wolverine was going to continue past this movie, it would not feel the same at all. And like, there were rumors that they were going to do like a Laura movie or like an X-23 movie that he was supposed to write and direct, that fell apart when Disney bought Fox. But like, I'm actually really glad that fell apart. Not because, you know, I wouldn't love to see Daphne Keane, you know, kick people with her foot talon some more, but like, this is such a complete story, and it ends on such a feeling of hope for the future again, that I think that to tell any more story past this would just be spoiling what's so good about this. And I will say, like, I don't think that we have seen the James Mangold fallout from this movie quite yet. It might be Indiana Jones 5. Like, being able to take that over from Spielberg is a pretty big move as a director. And I think that, like, being able to take this concept and have it go from, like, the Wolverine, which everyone saw but kind of forgot, to, like, this is, I think, one of the most iconic comic book movies. And to have it make as much money as it did, like, I don't think that James Mangold is going to be hurting for a job for, you know, if he wants to make studio movies like he's doing now, like, he's going to be making studio movies for a decade and a half at this point, like, past this, if he wants to keep going. Like, this is, you know, the movie that I think he's going to be able to kind of hang his hat on for potentially the rest of his career. And of course, it gets just one up to the next, you know, 2 years later when he makes Ford v Ferrari, and that gets a surprise Best Picture nomination. And, like, you know, he just manages to carry things out. So
the other thing that he's doing too with this movie and Ford v Ferrari, and I would hazard to guess, if you go back and you look, it won't be this way with Indy, just by the nature of it. But I would hazard that if you go back and you look at the rest of his movies, he's making super high quality movies that look great. This movie looks great. Ford v Ferrari looks great. Pretty much all of his movies, except for Kate and Leopold, look great. And he's doing that. He's making a super high quality, good looking, beautiful movie for cheap, comparatively.
Yes.
I mean, and that is something that I love, that I hope. I mean, I don't know what the budget is like on these two other movies he's doing. There's, like, nothing on it on IMDb, so I have no idea if it's, like, actually that's a $300 million movie or it's a $2 million movie. I don't know. But, like, I am big on, I would love for us to find more. I would think that I guess what I'm trying to say is, I would think that in Hollywood circles, he's very well received with studios and production companies and you know, producers and whatnot. Hey, this dude is making really, really good movies that do not look cheap at all, and they're actually relatively cheap compared to what we're you know, used to paying out on these kinds of things. So there's a real skill to be able to make a Ford v Ferrari for under $100 million, because you know going in that movie's not going to make Avengers money, so you got to find ways to make those things happen if you want to see them get to the screen instead of getting to the Netflix, you know.
Right. And that's another one where it's like, you know, it was already in production before he signed on and everything. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I guess we just haven't seen, like, the passion project, I guess, born from the success of these movies yet.
Sure.
But I would love to see it. I do think also that this is, like, the movie that kickstarts, like, the lesser James Mangold as an auteur storyline, I guess, where, like, I think even up to the Wolverine in his filmography, at any point, if you were like, oh, a new James Mangold movie's coming out, the vast majority of the public is going to say who, and then the public who cares about such things will be like, oh, yeah, okay, like, that guy can be good sometimes. And then, like, Logan and Ford v Ferrari back to back, I think Logan then made the hype for Ford v Ferrari, like, go through the roof in movie circles. And, like, now that movie also hit, I, you know, there's the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull factor. Brian, cover your
unfamiliar
ears. Yeah. That you have to worry about when it comes to, like, Indiana Jones 5. So I think that's the only reason why, like, the hype on that is a little bit more muted, but I feel like whatever else this guy's going to work on, like, it's going to reach hype levels now because of this movie and because of Ford v Ferrari.
Yeah. And also, like, I mean, I'm pulling it up as I speak, like, that, that movie, if it existed, let's say, hypothetically,
if Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was anything but a fan fiction,
right? It made, like, $800 million. So, like, it's gonna do, I would be, I mean, who knows in the time of Corona, which apparently is never going to end. We get your shots, people. But who knows? Who knows what things are going to be like in this period? But like, I would be very surprised if, even if that movie sucks, the new one, that it doesn't make like a crap ton of money. And so, you know, it's that's an easy one. If you're James Mangold, that's an easy one to take because it's kind of a win-win. Like, if it's 2% better than the last one, hypothetically, if that the last one existed, right. Then like you're like, hey, you're the guy that saved Indiana Jones. And if it doesn't, right. You can so easily be like, look, dude, it's freaking Disney and Harrison Ford. You don't think I want to get paid $20 million? Of course I do. Like, that'll fund my next four movies.
I think
it's a great win-win for him.
If nothing else, I mean, I trust in James Mangold to make it at least interesting. But if nothing else, I think he's going to get the Force Awakens boost where it's like, well, the last movie we saw was the Star Wars prequels.
Right.
And now you made this. And so it's great.
Yeah,
and I mean, I love The Force Awakens, but still.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, again, if you hypothetically, I don't know how, I'm sorry, I derailed this horribly, like, if you
talk Indiana Jones all day. Yeah,
if you watch a hypothetical fourth film, you can see that there's like, I mean, it's like 80% there. It's just that the 20% is so mind-bogglingly stupid and out there and doesn't match the tone of these movies at all. Like, that's the part that... So, I'm not real concerned about the fifth one being frankly, I'm like legit hype for the fifth one. Like, I don't know.
Too,
like, people that are out on it based on the fourth one, I'm like, y'all know what happened with the fourth one, right? Like, these have almost nothing to do with each other.
Right.
It's just pretend like it didn't happen, like I've been doing for over a decade, and I'm sure it's gonna be fun, if nothing else.
I just like the visual of like James Mangold coming in. They roll out Steven Spielberg's old whiteboard, and he just picks up chalk and he just goes over to the word aliens and just like scribbles all over it.
Yes. Which, by the way, is what would have happened with that one if Steven Spielberg was not there. Just wasn't a way that Steven Spielberg was going to be able to look George Lucas in the eye the next time they went to Hawaii together if he just said, George, we're not doing aliens. We're not doing Area 54. Like, what are we talking about? We can't do that, man. Like, in hindsight, I wish that not in just hindsight, probably like 1 second after the movie started, I was like, I wish Steven Spielberg hadn't done this. Like, if it had gotten handed off to somebody else, probably somebody says, hey, man, we can't do aliens. That doesn't work with this world. Like, what were you thinking? Like, just, yeah, anyway. Sorry, got on my...
it's just, God, we should just do a Kingdom of the Crystal Skull episode pre-Indiana Jones 5, and we'll just bring you on, and we won't have a format, we won't do any of our normal segments, we'll just, you and I can just go back and forth for an hour and a half.
You know what's funny? I may have told this story on our podcast before, but I saw that movie twice on opening weekend because I had set up... I had set up this big movie watching day with like all of our, it was because Memorial Day weekend. So it was Memorial Day,
right?
That
right.
Like my whole group of friends and like, you know, outside friends, like this whole group of people from my church, we were all going to go together and it was my event. I was the one that set this whole thing up on Memorial Day. So there's like 25 people going to see this together, 30 people, something like that. But I had two other friends that were super so psyched about this as well. And so we went to see it on Friday night or Saturday night. I can't remember. I don't think we did a midnight showing, but we might have. I don't know. And I went to see the movie, and I was just, like, devastated, you know. I'm just like, this is so bad. This is such a frustrating departure from everything that I love about this series, and I can't believe that we're doing this. And then I had to turn around 3 days later to go see this with somebody else and this whole group. And if I wasn't in charge of the event, I would have just bailed. There was no way that I wanted to do it again. But one of my buddies at the time one of my closest friends in this group, like I knew he's just this huge Indiana Jones person. And so I'm sitting next to him as the movie starts, and when it pans out, you know, or when it's, I mean, literally, it's like the first scene of the movie when it says Area 54 or whatever. He turns to me, just like shoots around and looks at me, and he's like, he didn't even say anything. He just like turns and stares at me, and I go, "Yup, it's like that." And he's just like, "Oh my god!" And he's just. And so the whole movie, it helped me seeing it the second time, like just being able to turn to him and watching him like suffer for the first time, you know, it was kind of cathartic in a way. But anyway,
yeah, it's that sounds awful. That's like,
yeah,
that's knowing that you set yourself up to be tortured a second time. Yeah. I mean, I was 13 when I saw that movie in theaters. And even, like, walking out of the theater, I was like, that was bad, guys. Yeah. Like, that was not good.
And to this day, you still haven't let me watch it.
No, but we will before 5, and then you can hate it, too. That reminds me of when I saw Iron Man 3, legitimately one of my most hated movies of all time, 7 times the first week it was out. Because I had set up so many, like, I was like, oh, I see Marvel movies with this group of friends and this group of friends and my parents and my other parents. And so, like, that week, after watching the midnight premiere and hating it, every single person texted me and was like, we have to go see Iron Man 3 because it's what we do. And I'm like, okay, here we go.
I'm going to say that has a little, like 5% to do with hating that movie as much as you do. If you saw it that many times
if I saw it once or twice, I think I could set it aside in my brain. But because I saw it 7 times, back to back, essentially,
I feel you.
I can never look objectively at that movie. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, make sure that you catch Brian over at Mad About Movies. I love that podcast. And again, they talk about typically, a new movie every week for the most part?
Yep, new movie every week on our main feed, and hopefully we're continuing to have movies. We'll see over the next few months, but yeah, the intention is to see. We talk about the biggest movie of the week most weeks on our main feed episode, and then
so we're not getting a Pig episode, Brian.
I will see Pig at some point. I know Kent has already seen it, but I don't know that we're gonna get an episode on
Pig.
It.
Is good, Brian. I'm telling that's what you, I've heard. Pig is I've good. Heard.
Is Pig good if you don't love way wheels off Nicolas Cage? Because
yes,
I'm not sure
he's
I love
not
wheels
off
Nicolas
at all.
Cage. Okay, I'm interested.
He's not. It's actually like one of the most restrained Nicolas Cage performances.
All right, that helps. That helps for me. But and then on our VIP feed, which is a Patreon subscription, which you can do for $5 a month, we do once a week. We do a throwback episode. So we're doing like Stand By Me next week, I believe, or this week, whatever it is. We're also doing like retrospective. So we have an Office. I think we're on season 5 of The Office coming up this month. And the Marvel movies, we're going through character by character or phase by phase or whatever. So, yeah, lots of fun stuff over there. And then we have a Discord as part of that VIP experience. That's a great time. We have, I don't know, several hundred or several dozen or whatever people talking all the time about movies and TV and travel and beautiful celebrities and everything else. So it's a fun time.
And I'm in there, so if you ever talk about Just Mercy or Iron Man 3, I'm contractually obligated to show up, so for very different reasons.
Right.
So please, you know, check out Brian and his co-hosts over at Mad About Movies. Do you have socials that you want to give out?
Yeah, sure. Mad About Movies, at Mad About Movies on Twitter. I think it's been a while since I've handed out the socials. I think Instagram is the same. Mad About Movies podcast on Instagram. But then, you know, just subscribe to the show. It's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, every podcast platform that there is. I think we're probably on it. So hit that up.
For sure. Well, special thanks to Michael Thompson for our logo. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe, and follow this podcast. If you have Indiana Jones thoughts, I guess, you can email us at discoveringdirectorspodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us at @DDirectorPod on Twitter, or follow us at Discovering Directors Podcast on Facebook. And next week, you're getting just the dynamic duo, me and Paige, back again to talk about Ford v. Ferrari. And then, just like normal, you'll get that episode on Wednesday, and on Saturday, you will get our James Mangold rap party. where we're going to discuss our rankings of his movies, our rankings of some of his characters. We'll come up with a fun little bit, and then we'll say goodbye to James Mangold. And the week after that, we will start our new season of Guillermo del Toro. So if you guys want to get ahead on that, here is your two-week notice. So join us next week for 4 of You Ferrari and our wrap party. Thank you all for coming.
Bye-bye.